Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hello everyone, fellow travellers, wherever and whenever you are. Welcome to the latest episode of the Neil Oliver Show, in lieu of the love letters that Paul and I have been specialising in more recently. This is, as I said, it's been an opportunity to open the whole conversation up. Rather than just listening to me, I want to share space and time with those that I find inspirational, informative, instructive, and so we'll get straight into it with today's guest, David Craden, a journalist in Canada. David also served with the Canadian Armed Forces. Our paths, David and mine, crossed in that mysterious alchemical way that has brought me into contact with just about everyone I speak to now. In David's case particularly, I sense a kindred spirit. I was aware of what David was saying online about all sorts of subjects close to my heart, and I sensed that we were in rhythm, that we were simpatico. All of this as well is enveloped in a sense that I get from David that I feel too, a sense of bewilderment about so much that's going on. It makes no sense to me. For me, as you all know on here, it started with the COVID debacle. But that was only a key that opened a door, or more accurately, opened my eyes to so much else that's going on. And suffice to say, there's so much that I could talk to with David Craden, so that I almost don't know where to start. But I will start with a simple hello and welcome, David Craden.
Well, Neil, it's so nice to be here, and we're going to have a wonderful conversation.
As I said, hardly know where to start, because I could start anywhere with you, I think. But I suppose to get us off on what I think might be a useful path, I would like to invite you to comment on the thought that troubles me most of all, really, when I look at things in the round. That the leaders of the West seem to me to be following, pushing an agenda that is simply anti-human, that does not have our interests, and certainly not our best interests, at heart. What say you?
Well, what strikes me as so unusual, Neil, is that it's the English-speaking democracies that are going down a path in unison that seems to be not only anti-human, but blatantly authoritarian, if not totalitarian. And of course, the late, great Winston Spencer Churchill used to speak about the English-speaking democracies, wrote an entire series of books about the English-speaking democracies. These are supposed to be the foundation, the fount of freedom in the world. And of course, we're speaking of Great Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. These are the countries that have always demonstrated democracy under fire during wartime, during Great Depressions, during times of huge dislocation. And yet, all it took was a pandemic that really wasn't as serious as they made it out to be to utterly destroy the foundations of these democracies. And we see this blatantly in Canada. We have a prime minister who gets increasingly dictatorial by the day. And I'll bring up an incident that happened yesterday shortly. But we have an Australian prime minister who's now forbidding any criticism or any caricatures of him appearing on the internet. it's not only that they're authoritarian, they've lost their sense of humor. This is the sort of thing that was commonplace in Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia. You weren't allowed to joke about your leaders. You weren't allowed to make fun of them. And this seems to be the first thing that has fallen through here in all of these countries. The hyper-seriousness of what I'm doing is just so important. It's so significant to the history of civilization. Don't get in my way. And I see this so much with the hate speech legislation that you're experiencing in Scotland. Now, your leader there, the Scottish National Party leader, is resigning, which I covered the other day. I don't know if that's going to affect this ridiculous hate crime and public order law you have there, but I'm hoping there might be some effect in Canada where we are considering legislation that's even more odious. And I hope this is going to energize the opposition to this law in Canada. But all of this, as you say, Neil, is it's anti-human because it really wants to silence and cancel anybody who isn't part of the narrative, who's not singing along in unison to this perverse chorus, which is the only way I can describe having a musical background. It's a perverse chorus, and I'm not joining in.
You raise something that's been on my mind recently. In fact, I've spoken about it very recently in the public domain, that lack of sense of humor and that pomposity and that unwillingness to take a joke. I'm painfully aware of that in our so-called leaders as well. And I wonder if it's symptomatic of that divide, which must be there now, that them and us, that those who have obtained control see themselves as a separate caste, as it were. And while they're prepared to talk to and listen to one another, they consider themselves to be above and certainly separate from the common herd, which is you and I, and mm-hmm. and that their sensitivity, their ridiculously heightened sensitivity about being teased is symptomatic of that abyss that they now think exists between the leaders and the led.
Well, I often feel like I'm living in 1933 Germany, and I often wondered, what was it like to go from the Weimar Republic, where they had proportional representation, to a Nazi system in a matter of months? The transition was so rapid. They used events to justify seizing greater and greater power. And I often wondered, what did it feel like to lose your democracy overnight? You know, not literally, but in a matter of months, you know, with the Reichstag fire and the Enabling Act and all of those things that occurred in the early months of Hitler's reign, if you will. And I think I can understand it. It happens in front of your eyes, in the full knowledge of the media, which is watching, but yet is very much in the pocket of Justin Trudeau. And I think this is indicative of how societies, even one like Canada, that's been a strong democracy for 150 odd years and before Confederation, it was a democratic country under British rule. How does it go from that to a system where we have a prime minister who simply ignores the wishes of parliament, ignores the people, ignores questions every day in question period, and insists upon talking about three subjects that are near and dear to his heart, one of which is climate change and the other is Ukraine. And now he wants to talk about far-right white supremacist groups that don't even exist in Canada. And this is his agenda, and he simply changes the subject when anybody asks him a question. So I think I understand how this happened in Germany, and I think it's happening in Canada, and I think it's happening in the United States. God help us if the next election there is not freely contested. As I believe it certainly is subject to that kind of I think it's subject. I have to state this carefully because I don't want to be banned from YouTube. But I think it's subject to some controversy, and I think it has to be those aspects have to be carefully analyzed. So
you touched there in something else that I have noticed, you know, along with the way in which they seem and seek and insist on taking themselves so seriously. And you talk about that unmissable rapidity of the change, that's that feeling of it all having altered overnight, not literally, but all having altered very quickly. A lot of us were very sensitive to the way in which suddenly all of the elected heads were using the same language at the same time, which was suggestive of a script that had been circulated among them all from author or authors unknown, so that they used common expressions like great reset, narrow window of opportunity, all in it together, build back better. There were litanies or dogma that just appeared overnight. And you mentioned the way in which Trudeau is obsessed with Ukraine amongst in a narrow set of obsessions. I noticed that elsewhere on your channel, you played a clip of Boris Johnson, former British Prime Minister. I think he was in Ottawa, but he was addressing an audience in Canada. And he talked about Ukraine having been, these might not be his exact words, but the sense was it having been a good value for money, a good investment for the US, for Canada, for anybody, because after all, it wasn't our soldiers who were dying. Those lives were not being lost. And that there was a great return on investment because the money, the massive amounts of money were being pumped into the military industrial complex. Now, that assertion that it's value for money is everywhere now. I've heard British Foreign Secretary David Cameron, another former British Prime Minister, ennobled to the House of Lords just so they could give him the job of Foreign Secretary because he was not an elected MP at the time, using the same form of words. Rishi Sunak, the present British Prime Minister, talking about putting Britain's defence industry on a war footing. And I find that deeply sinister. So that's suggestive to me that somewhere someone has changed the narrative and sent out the script to everyone. Because once upon a time, we were saving democracy in Ukraine and they were all saying that. They don't say that anymore. Now they say, as though with one voice, it's a great investment. You know, is there, do you sense a collectivization behind the seats of power?
Well, precisely, because Boris Johnson was here as a guest at the what used to be the Preston Manning Foundation. It's now the Canada Strong and Free Networking Conference. And this is Canada's CPAC. This is the equivalent of what they do in the United States with all conservative groups. It's not run by the Conservative Party, but there's heavy representation from the Conservative Party of Canada. Pierre Poilievre was a keynote speaker at this event. There's lots of conservative MPs. I think half the caucus usually shows up. But there's a lot of small C conservatives and small L libertarians who show up for this conference. And so Boris Johnson is here. And I'm thinking, what on earth did they invite Boris Johnson for? I consider him a clown. He's a disgraced party animal politician who really has no business calling himself a conservative. But he shows up, and what does he want to talk about? Well, exactly what Justin Trudeau wants to talk about, and that's Ukraine. And as you said, he literally did say it was good value for your money, because we're not dying. Canadians aren't dying. Brits aren't dying. Americans aren't dying. Ukrainians are dying. So what's the problem? And yes, all the money's going into the armaments industry, of which Canada is really a branch plant of the United States. I mean, we have been for decades. So yes, the military spending benefits Canada as well. And we all know that. So Boris Johnson is holding forth, and he, of course, looks like he just staggered out of bed when he gets there. His tie is askew, his suit rumpled, his hair going in every which way as usual. And he has the nerve to tell us this. And not only that, the unspoken part of this that was only seen on social media, it never really made it to the legacy media at all, was when he went to the House of Commons to glad hand people he, I guess, apparently knew. At the front door, he runs into no one else, none other than our environment minister, Stephen Gilbo, who is, of course, a former Greenpeace activist who was a convicted felon when he scaled the CN Tower as a prank. And now he's the environment minister that is killing Canada's oil and gas industry. He's killing it incrementally with legislation, full support of Justin Trudeau, of course. And what does Boris Johnson do? He almost embraces Gilbo at the front door. And this was all captured on film by an amateur journalist who was on scene capturing this. Embraces Gilbo and says, "You're doing a terrific job." It's a terrific job. And this is a man, of course, who is the bête noire of most conservatives in this country, because he is on an extremist environmental agenda that is so obsessed with climate change that Canadians might as well be living in caves to reach his objectives. And even if we did, of course, live in caves, if we stopped heating our homes, stopped driving cars, stopped traveling by airline, we wouldn't make a dent in the global greenhouse gas emissions, the global ones, because Canada produces about 1% of those global gas emissions. So the whole thing is an exercise in futility, but also in self-strangulation of our Canadian industry and our economy. And people are watching this and saying, where is this leading? Where are we going? But Boris Johnson apparently thinks he's doing a terrific job. So that to me says, do these people have any principles? Or is this a grand farce? Is this a grand illusion? Is this all about these politicians? They're all in on the joke. They're all in on the gag together. As you said, they're getting their marching orders from the WEF, from Klaus Schwab. And Trudeau makes no bones about the fact he's a good friend of Klaus Schwab. Klaus Schwab has praised him as the epitome of the modern leader who takes his orders from the globalist agenda. But are they all in this together because they're getting the same orders and they're smiling wryly when they meet each other, even if they're supposed to be on different sides of the house, even if they're supposed to be on polar opposites in terms of ideology? They're not. They're all working on this together, and they know it's the people like you and I. It's the ordinary chaps, as George Orwell used to say, who are suffering the most, because we're not in on the joke. We're the butt of the joke. We are the ones who the joke is being played upon. And I think this is indicative of how corrupt politics has become, is that there's no principle anymore. There's no sense of, I'm doing this because I believe passionately in what I'm doing. I don't think they believe in anything except power anymore, and except advancing a globalist agenda that has nothing to do with my interests or yours.
I concur with everything that you had to say there, David. I have to say, but you bring me back to this sense I have of the anti-human nature of it all. You know, mm-hmm. While I agree that it feels like, you know, the joke is on us and that they are all in on it, it's certainly not funny. And I wonder at the extent to which you think that, is it an illusion that they seem to be walking us towards the Third World War? Mm-hmm. You know, there's talk of, you know, Poland wants nuclear weapons, or there's talk of positioning nuclear weapons in Poland, which seems like a suicide note for the world were that to happen. And, you know, we've got the World Economic Forum that you've already mentioned that seems, you know, driven towards, will stop short of nothing but the surrender of national sovereignty, individual sovereignty, the surrender of rights and bodily autonomy. We've got, as you say, the likes of Trudeau pushing this green agenda, so-called, which I would prefer to call a greed agenda, because somebody somewhere mm-hmm. is getting rich off the back of all the nonsense. But it's making life impossible for your fellow Canadians. It's increasingly making life impossible for people in the United Kingdom and in Scotland. Where do they stop? Do you think that they really would? I mean, is there an insanity level where they would actually walk us properly into a third world war with the potential for nuclear destruction? Or are they just dangling fear in front of all of our faces while in the background they dismantle the lives that we have known?
That is such an excellent question, and I don't think I have pondered that sufficiently up till now, because I look at this as, yes, we are two steps away from a nuclear war. We have been for the last year. I've been writing extensively about this because, as a former military person, I think I have some skin in the game. I think we're closer to nuclear war today than we were in 1962, October 1962, with the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was always sort of been pegged as the high watermark of the Cold War and where we came closest to a nuclear confrontation and a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. But fortunately, there was a president in the United States at that time who was both logical, rational, and capable of compromise and capable of finding solutions. Right now, we have a president of the United States who's clearly suffering from dementia. There's no debate about that as far as I'm concerned. He's not in control of the White House. He's not in control of the agenda. I wonder if he's in control of the nuclear button. I doubt it very much. So we're left with a bunch of really obnoxious kids running the White House. And of course, it's the U.S. really who's making the decisions on this, on how far NATO is going to go, how much brinkmanship is going to be employed to try to get the Russians out of Ukraine, which is not going to happen. And Vladimir Putin has been quite clear that he's not going to be cowed out of Ukraine by threats from NATO. He's prepared to use nuclear weapons if he thinks it's justified in Russia's interest. But is this all theater? As you say, as they continue to lay the foundation for this new world order that is clearly in preparation, I don't know if they are in control of it anymore. I guess I would have to say that, because every once in a while in history, the events get out of control. It happened in the First World War. Nobody wanted the First World War in June or July 1914. Nobody wanted it. To see their empires and their monarchies vanish in 4 years. Nobody wanted to see, or few people in the West anyway, wanted to see a Bolshevik regime in Russia. But it happened because events rapidly got out of control. And I don't know if you can play this game with nuclear war and think you can win it and think you can use it for your self-interest and you can just use it as a scare tactic so people will knuckle under. Because I'm not seeing the sort of caution, the alarm bells that used to go off. I mean, we both grew up in the Cold War. We're virtual contemporaries. I remember the 1980s when people were convinced that we were on the verge of nuclear war, and there was so much publicity about that. I don't see that at all today. I don't see the media in the UK or in the United States or Canada fretting about the potential nuclear war on the horizon. And what this would mean, that hundreds of millions of people would be dead within hours. I don't see that. And so I think they might be trying to use this as a means of leverage, but I don't think it's going to be successful. They're playing with fire here, to use a terrible cliche, but they are playing with fire, and it can rapidly escape their control.
I can't decide, David, whether I believe them or not. You know, the brinkmanship, they're playing chicken, or they appear to be playing chicken with one another. And I'm alive to the possibility that nuclear war is possible. I am. But I also, about 50% of me, can't shake the suspicion that it is theatre. Because let's imagine there's a grand plan for centralized global control. I think that plan would have to predate, the emergence of the proliferation of nuclear weaponry it would have to predate the technology of biological warfare. I think that intention possibly comes from a less technologically advanced period of our history and has simply been handed from one generation to the next. And that mm-hmm. now the people who have the levers of power are in this almost invidious position where they're supposed to conclude the plan, but there's the, you know, there's the potential for nuclear destruction releasing a pathogen on the species. But I can't shake off my suspicion that they will not do that because both options are bad for business. Because my suspicion is that what is intended is the creation of a digital gulag, mm-hmm. Where a very narrow group, an elite group, have all the power and all the good stuff, and the rest of us are reduced to a kind of digital serfdom, a digital feudalism. And that, you know, they're making the incremental steps towards that all of the time. And why would you ruin all of that with a nuclear war that's going to smash all your windows? Why would you ruin all that by releasing airborne Ebola, you know, which your grandchildren would also be at threat from? So I can't help feeling that we're being played on a global scale, cowed into submission, cowed into wanting to be protected, cowed into wanting the kind of security that they profess to be able to offer, so that in the end we simply meekly submit to our futures in that digital gulag archipelago.
That's a fascinating hypothesis, and I certainly wouldn't reject it out of hand, because this is all a very sinister game. But of course, Russia and China would have to be in on the game as well. And I'm not 100% convinced they really are, if they have any time for these globalist masters. And if that's not the case, then the West might be very disappointed that they don't play along with this game. And I don't for a minute think that Anthony Blinken or the other people surrounding Biden really want to submerge the world into a nuclear war any more than other administrations in the past did. But I do question whether or not the events can get out of control, because it's very possible that mistakes can be made, not necessarily by the Anthony Blinkens and the Richie Sunaks of the world. And I think Blinken is more in charge of diplomacy right now than Joe Biden is. Whether that's good or bad, I can't decide. But I do think that they are convinced, they're very arrogant in thinking they've got this under control, that they are the ones pulling the levers. But you have to remember, in a nuclear war, we almost had incidents throughout those 50, 60 years of the Cold War where mistakes were made and accidents happened, and we almost had nuclear war at times because stupid mistakes made at a very low level. And that could happen again, because everybody has to be aware of the narrative. Everybody has to be aware of where this is going, what the objective is. And if there's true believers at the mid-level of management who think we need to have a war with Russia because Russia needs to be punished, they could well pursue that agenda without the full support of the upper echelon. And I think that's highly possible. But I think you've struck on something. I mean, how stupid are these people? Do they really want to start a nuclear war over Ukraine, or are they using it? I think they think they're probably going to be able to control this. I'm not sure they can indefinitely. And the potential for a mistake to occur, for a potential nuclear accident, increases rapidly as more and more countries talk about sending troops to Ukraine. That's talk about actively joining the fight, pretending that the European Union can fight Russia, but that's not NATO. That's insanity. Yes, any NATO country that's also a member of the European Union would put NATO, all NATO countries at war immediately. It's a core doctrine of NATO. And to suggest that, well, the EU can do it without NATO's auspices is not just insane. It's just frankly irrational and false. So I'm very concerned that one way or the other, we're either headed towards the road to totalitarianism or we're headed for nuclear war. And I'm not sure there's enough discourse and argument in the legacy media to avert that right now. And I think that's why people like you and I need to keep the issue in the forefront and to keep the debate going, because otherwise we're being told what to do constantly. And to get back to your initial question and statement, it's the anti-human agenda, as you said. We are being told how to live, how to think, how to speak, what is permissible. And that to me is the great deception of our day, is that we no longer have the freedom to choose, the freedom to be human. And I was thinking the other day of a book I read years ago, and I'd forgotten about it, written by a very controversial figure, G. Gordon Liddy, of course, was associated with Nixon and Watergate. But he wrote a fantastic book called When I Was a Kid, This Was a Free Country. And and this was, of course, years before things became where they are today. But he was just talking about the incremental loss of freedom, of little things that you can't do anymore, you can't say anymore. You're not allowed to do because it's politically incorrect, or there's laws in place to stop you. And I thought about this the other day, because that's where we're coming in Canada. We're afraid to say anything. The chill is so substantial. The chill on free speech is so substantial. So I do think we're headed in one or the other direction, totalitarianism or a nuclear war.
I wonder often about the possibility that we've simply passed a point in our civilization where enough people are aware that the kind of civilization in which you and I have grown up is not natural. I wonder at the extent to which too many people think that the way things are, you grew up in Canada, I grew up in Scotland, think that that's just in the nature of human existence, and that too many people have lost track of just how incredibly unlikely our circumstances actually have been and continue to be, however fragile that has become. Mm. You know, that people think that the barbarians are just held at the gates, that we live in streets that you can walk at night, that are lit, that are safe, you know, that you can stand at a bus stop and a bus will come at the appointed time, that you can go to the supermarket and the food will be there, that you can go to the auto teller and put in your card and the money will magically arrive. That too many people think that just happens, and that inevitably when you cross that tipping point, that too many people take that for granted, that it then just becomes inevitable that we lose it, and that the opportunity to take it from us is seized upon by the likes of those that have put themselves in charge now, and that coupled with this anti-human agenda, you know, puts us all in terrible jeopardy, because we're being casual with our rights, casual with our freedom, casual with our security. And we've left it in the hands of those who care for us not a jot.
Yeah. Well, I've heard you speak about this at length on your broadcast, and I found it quite fascinating. I mean, I remember one particular episode where we talked about the democracy we enjoy today, or we still enjoy to some degree, is something that's historically irregular. We went for millennia without democratic freedom. And this is a bit of a reversal. This is a new thing. This is not the norm. And those who don't like it are trying to reverse the situation, that the history will rectify itself, as you will. I know you've said this, and I find that quite fascinating. But yesterday in our House of Commons, we had a very unusual incident, and I don't think it can be overplayed. What happened yesterday is that the Speaker of the House of Commons, and for your American audience, the Speaker in the British parliamentary system, as Canada has adopted, is supposed to be a non-partisan figure, not like the House Speaker in the United States, where it's a very partisan position. The Speaker of the House of Commons is supposed to be a non-partisan figure. He or she can belong to a political party, and they always do, But while speaker, they are supposed to jettison that allegiance. And their primary allegiance is to all members of the House, to the House of Commons, to parliamentary decorum. So Greg Fergus is an ardent liberal, and he has said things publicly since becoming speaker that no speaker should ever have said. Things that are blatantly partisan in terms of his being a Liberal Party member and supporting the Liberal Party. And yesterday, he threw out the leader of the official opposition, Peter Polyev, the Conservative Party of Canada leader, based on the fact he used two words to describe Justin Trudeau. He said he was a wacko and an extremist.
Sounds perfectly reasonable to me.
Well, seems reasonable to anybody. And that's certainly, as one former politician remarked yesterday, on a scale of 1 to 10, wacko is about a 2.5. Tom Mulcair actually said that, who was the former leader of the New Democratic Party. He said that was just so ridiculous. And he's calling for the speaker to resign over this. Because what was suspicious about this whole incident, Neil, is that it's like he was waiting for Polyev to say anything. Because he already had the standing order in front of him to say that because you said this, I have the right to throw you out of the House of Commons. I have the right to throw you out of question period according to the standing order. And he had the paper in front of him. Was he ready for this? Was he waiting for this? Did Trudeau tell him, get Polyev out of here today? Because I don't want to answer any questions about drug recriminalization. And that was the issue of the hour yesterday, because British Columbia is suffering from such an excess of opioid and heroin overdoses because they decriminalized all drugs in the province because the federal government said so. And they have made BC exempt from all laws regulating hard drugs. And Toronto as a city also wants to go down this route. So Polyev is saying, stop this insane policy. It's killing people. It is not working. Even the leftist government of BC is saying so. So did Trudeau talk to the speaker beforehand and say, get rid of him, punish him, make an example of him, make sure we put the chill in these members so that they stop asking me these questions? And so Trudeau, of course, did not even respond to the question about whether he intends to recriminalize hard drugs in BC. He went on and ranted about some mythical far-right organization called Diagolon, which is nothing more than a meme on the internet. It's basically a bunch of guys who get together and talk nonsense. And they certainly have no desire to actively support Peter Polyev, and Peter Polyev is not actively seeking their support, especially since they said some very nasty things about his wife. And this was well documented, and Polyev was furious about this. He has no connection to some group called Diagolon. And Trudeau, of course, is making them out to be some grand conspiracy that they're trying to overthrow the government. And he had the nerve to say Pierre Polyev is associating with a gang of white supremacists. Yet Trudeau was the white supremacist for most of his adult life, donning blackface and performing in private and public doing this. But he has the unalloyed narcissism to suggest it's everybody else's problem, but not his. And he's not the one who's the racist. Polyev somehow is, because I'm going to say he has a connection to this group that even doesn't exist. So, but for a speaker to throw out the leader of the opposition, that is a new low in Canadian politics. And even non-conservatives are saying he went too far. You can't do that. You can't shut down debate like that in the House of Commons during question period. And the speaker cannot be in the pocket of the Prime Minister of Canada. And clearly he is. And this was outrageous by anyone's estimation outside of Trudeau and his cabinet. I think a lot of Liberal caucus members would find this inadvisable and unacceptable. So it's incidents like this, Neil, that convince me that democracy is fragile, as you say, but it's endangered very much here in Canada, just as it is in other countries.
What do you make of the way in which events in Canada seem to be paralleled by events in Scotland so much of the time? Mm-hmm. You know, by which I mean, you know, you've already mentioned, I think, the hate crime legislation in Scotland, and you have similar in Canada. And that which you just mentioned, that, you know, that way in which any kind of dissenting voice, any kind of contrary position, is not challenged in terms of the substance of what point is being made, what question is being asked. There's just this resorting to labelling, you know, extremism, whatever, far right, and also to seeking to damage people by association. You know, there's this instinct. I think in Canada, you know, Polyev is also damned by association with the fact that Alex Jones has spoken about him and said that he's the real deal. I think is the term that he used, and that suddenly, because the fact that somebody that, you know, may or may not have a more questionable reputation than you do says something in your favour is also something that must be used to bring you down. We've also got in Scotland now, we've got a bid to broaden out the potential of assisted dying to make it easier for people who are terminally ill to seek help with ending their lives. And obviously, you're much, much further down a dark road in Canada, in the same area. Why do you think small country, well, small populations, let's say, relative, why do you think these small countries are running on parallel tracks?
I guess it's easier to manage a smaller population, and it's easier for these leaders to introduce legislation that I think would be, still in the United States, would still be seen as, it was verboten. We don't want a government euthanasia project. Somehow this slipped through the cracks in Canada. And it has, as everybody said, you know, we always talk about that slippery slope, and it's become a terrible cliche. But it's always true. You take one step down that slope, and you inevitably will continue a decline. And so what has been the effect of this euthanasia, or it's called medical assistance in dying. I mean, what a euphemism for a euthanasia program. It has just continually been expanded. And of course, the next step, they put it off for a year, but the next step will be the mentally ill. And of course, that is a huge category. That can mean anybody that's suffering from any kind of depression, self-harm, alcoholism, drug addiction, anything that can be construed as mental health. And these people will suddenly be eligible, as they like to say in the program, eligible for MAID or eligible for euthanasia. So it doesn't surprise me Scotland's going down this route. As you know, we discussed last time when you were on my show that Ireland has tried to go in this direction. And the Irish are saying, no, we're not going to redefine the traditional family. I mean, that was a victory for common sense. But there's certainly, this is where these things are being tried first, in the smaller countries. And I think it's because they're more malleable, because the media is not necessarily as vocal and as widespread and as universal in scope. So I think it's easier to do it there. But also in Canada's case, Canada's always been, you know, this likable, safe, polite country. I mean, it's a running gag is that Canadians are so polite. And so it's been easier to enforce this agenda here, because Canadians are too polite. They aren't complaining. And I think that's probably the case in Scotland too, from you know, the limited experience I've had in Scotland. I think these are nice people, polite people who aren't accustomed to rising up and saying, stop, the government has gone too far. Certainly that's the case in Canada. And it's unfortunate, because we are being sold a very, very, evil agenda here.
I mentioned already, I've invoked it a few times, that, you know, the anti-human agenda, and you've joined with me in considering that. When it comes to euthanasia, it seems to me like we're firmly back in the territory that would once have been described as eugenics.
Yeah.
I just wonder if eugenics and the eugenicists ever really went away. Or in truth, if part of what is driving the anti-human agenda is coming from that group who are always there in the shadows or fully exposed to the light, who believe that the species is up for improvement, tampering with. It's there in the transhumanism. I would say it's there in the transgenderism. And I would say that when it comes to making it easier for people who don't fit in whatever way, because they're sick, because they're sad, and many other ways in which you might filter people out, might as well just not be here. You know, just it's, as I said at the top, it's the anti-human nature, the casual disregard for fellow human beings that troubles me most of all.
Well, did the eugenicists ever go away? No, they didn't. They just got quieter. And they just found new ways of describing what they're doing. And this is why this medical assistance in dying program is a horrible euphemism. You know, and there are so many examples I could cite of terrible euphemisms that mean exactly the opposite of what they suggest. This is a program that was let loose, and inevitably it's gone down the eugenics route, because we're not just talking anymore about people who are so sick that they find no other alternative in their life but to end it. I don't agree with that. I never will. It goes against my constitution. It goes against my personal faith. But I think it's a little different than now saying we're going to target people who don't really fit in. And who fits in now? I don't think I would fit in because I'm too much of a critic. They would write me off as somebody who's interfering in their good order. And so I would certainly not be somebody that they want to sustain. And I think that's the danger of all of this. And I always go back to George Orwell, and I had to bring up George Orwell talking with you, Neil, because I've read everything George Orwell ever wrote. And when I was in university, I decided we had to read 1984. It's probably not even prescribed reading at Carleton University School of Journalism anymore. but it was in those days, and I had to read 1984, and I'd never actually read it until then. I was 18. And I decided I was going to read all of his journalism. And of course, it's all available, the collected works of George Orwell out there. And I read all of his novels. And I discovered this man who not only wrote 1984, which was an incredible classic, but had so many incredibly pertinent things to say about politics. Because what defines Orwell was an honesty, intellectual honesty, that is absent today from the political debate. He was a man who called himself a socialist who couldn't stand most socialists. Because they said they were so authoritarian to Orwell. They're always telling you what to eat. You couldn't drink this. And they were so eccentric in their habits. And they really didn't want people to make their own decisions. And they wanted the state to get more and more involved in your life. And this was a guy who just wanted to do his own thing by himself. He didn't want the state telling him what to do. And he saw the danger in socialism becoming this horrible force, this invasive force in your life. Long before he wrote 1984, long before he wrote that book, he saw the dangers on the horizon. And he had the intellectual honesty to identify them and to alienate himself from the socialists of his own period, many of which were pro-Stalinist, many of which thought the Soviet Union was the promised land. And of course, Orwell also saw through that illusion. He saw that that was nonsense. That this was a society completely like Nazi Germany and no different at all. So I long for that kind of intellectual honesty in the world and journalism today, where we can criticize ourselves. We can criticize assumptions that are made on our behalf. And we don't have to be afraid of being canceled. That's the great fear today. I think that defines our modern journalism is the fear of being canceled, that you don't exist anymore. And this, of course, is probably one of the most salient points of 1984, the cancelization. Orwell talked about that decades before it was even possible. He couldn't envision the internet. And of course, that when you read 1984, it's the one thing you say, well, you know, he couldn't see the internet coming. They were still dealing with typewriters and pens and that's that form of communication. But he described what the internet would wreak, what was going to bring. It was going to bring cancellation of people. People would disappear. People would no longer be thought of. And we have the technology to do that today. And I reread 1984 as an oral experiment on my website, as an oral book. And I hadn't read it in perhaps 5-6 years. And I saw so much in that book that was suddenly relevant, suddenly pertinent to the times I'm living in. And it was almost like, as a Christian, I can read the same text from the Bible 100 times, but it's the 101st time it speaks to me. I see something in that verse I'd never seen before. When I read 1984 again about 6 months ago, I saw things in that book I'd never seen before. I saw the world that was constantly at war. I saw the military-industrial establishment wanting to keep the war at world constantly because it was making them huge profits. I saw a world where people were being canceled and disappeared on the internet. And I saw a book that I had never read before in the same way. And it was amazing to me. It was like I could do a new exegesis on 1984 because I was reading it at the right time in history. And I've told that to many, many people. Most of them look at me a little askance, thinking, you think Orwell was divinely inspired? And I'm not suggesting that. I think his book is not just prescient. I think it is deeply profound and prophetic.
What I agree with you about how prescient 1984 was, but something that really comes through to me again when I reread it is his depiction of the deliberate drabness that was made of people's lives. You know, the tasteless food, the soulless accommodation, the meaningless occupation in the factories, a grayness, an overwhelming, damp, drab grayness that was being deliberately, sadistically imposed upon the people for no other reason, really, but that it amused Big Brother to have people living like that while simultaneously telling them that they had never had it so good. And I look on it, so much of what's being done to us or to the broader mm-hmm. population, and it just seems to be about immiserating people. You know, that you've been looking at the carbon tax in Canada. You know, we've all got versions of the same thing going on, courtesy of Agenda 2030 and the rest of it. It's just to immiserate people. It's just to make life. It's to take lives that were comfortable or at least bearable, and to make them uncomfortable and unbearable. And cranking up these taxes all the time is not because the authorities need that money. They just don't want the people to have it. They just want to immiserate them. I feel that increasingly about income tax. You know, where we live in the West, where all they do is print money anyway. You know, any money that the authorities need for Ukraine or whatever, they just create out of thin air anyway. So that you look at personal income tax and think, they can only be collecting that from people because they don't want the people to have the comfort of that money. And telling people that they can't have internal combustion engines in their cars and that therefore they can't have cars at all, and that they want to tell them what they can eat. You know, they want to take away the arable herd. They want to take away arable farming and the livestock, you know, so that people can't have access to the food that they've enjoyed in the past. So much of it just seems to be a drive to make people miserable. Mm-hmm. Now, where on earth does the motivation for immiserating the mass of the population come from? Are we just dealing with sociopaths and sadists?
I think you might have defined the condition of our age, the immiseration of civilization. That is precisely where we're going. And it is, you're so correct that they don't need our income tax to fund the projects they have. They do. They simply print more money because there's all the income tax in the world can no longer fund the projects that the federal government in the United States, for instance, is now funding. The open borders, I saw a report yesterday on Redacted from a former border security guard saying that they're literally spending hundreds of billions of dollars moving these illegal immigrants across America, sometimes giving them four or five COVID tests, for instance, at $20,000 a shot. The money is astronomical. And income taxes alone, of course, aren't going to pay for this. It's just they keep spending and they keep printing. And there's no end in sight. Just like the money for Ukraine, this is not the end. They will keep sending money to Ukraine until that's quite clear. The war is over. And of course, as I heard yesterday, this latest installment, these billions of dollars, are largely now in the pockets of corrupt politicians who are running out of the country with the money that we just sent them. Or the United States just sent them $61 billion. The cash they received, $9 billion in cash, is gone. They've already got, as Scott Ritter was saying this yesterday, that from his sources, that they've left the country with the $9 billion, not even there. And so, you know, you're quite correct. It's about making life cheap and very small for those of us who are trying to make some sense of all this. And of course, I guess all you're going to get is frustration if you try to make sense of all this. They're not doing this for our greater good. They're doing it for themselves. They're doing it to perpetuate their own power. They're doing it because they're following a foreign globalist master. I firmly believe that. I mean, it's quite evident. They couldn't make it clearer. And stop thinking that these politicians, that these leaders, these Western leaders, have your best interest at heart. They don't. It's not even clear they have their own best interest at heart. They're working for very evil forces, and these forces are consuming us. And I'm happy to be part of the resistance to this in any form it takes.
I look on at the that immiseration that you know, just describing, and I know you can't help but notice the emergence of those to whom the immiseration does not and will never apply. You know, when it comes, let's take, for example, the whole war on carbon. And I've said for a long time that we are the carbon that they want to reduce. but we already see the super rich, the Bill Gates and his ilk, that say that they will simply buy they will simply buy up the spare rights to pollute the world that poor people can't afford. Poor people can't afford to burn carbon, but they'll do it on our behalf. You know, they'll fly their private jets. You know, they'll consume the Chateaubriand. You know, they'll drink the fine wines because they can afford to pay the carbon taxes that the rest of us are ruined by. And I'm minded automatically of the indulgences that Martin Luther railed about at the time of the Reformation. You know, the very idea that you could free yourself from sin, get into heaven with cold, hard cash. You know, if you were rich enough and you could just hand over the money, you got an indulgence, and that absolved you of the need to repent. It was just a get-out-of-jail-free card. You know, and I suppose what I'm saying is, I mean, we've been speaking for an hour now, and I kind of let you out of here on your thoughts on this point. I wonder at the extent to which what, in effect, history teaches us we need is a kind of reformation. You know, Martin Luther, whatever you think of him, he did stick a pin into the self-indulgent pomposity of the rich, of the priesthood and the bishops of his own church. He pointed to something obvious. He made it obvious. And I wonder if there's some hope and some optimism in reminding enough of us, and I'm not talking here in religious terms at all, but a version of a reformation, you know, that whatever is the religion, if you like, the politics that governs our lives, it needs a root and branch reformation for the same reasons.
That is so profound, Neil. Because, of course, Martin Luther transcended religion. He was a great figure of freedom. Some people criticize him in his private life for various things. But he was a huge contributor to the notion that the individual mattered. The Roman Catholic Church was a huge monolithic force, I would say, for tremendous evil during the Middle Ages, the Inquisition being chief among those sins. But Luther challenged that institution and said, you don't have to necessarily allow it to continue to control your life. It doesn't need to, because we can fight back. And he became a figure not just of religious freedom, but political freedom. And I think that's his legacy. And yes, we do need a reformation, a political reformation, because the indulgence comparison is exactly it. And of course, an indulgence didn't just buy your own salvation. You could spring your kith and kin out of purgatory if you paid enough. So it transcended your own life. And that, I remember the old rhyme, when a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. And that's how the Roman Catholic Church sold this horrendous doctrine to its followers. And Luther just chopped it to pieces. So yes, we do need to rethink the way things are going. We need a new birth of freedom, to quote Lincoln. We do need something, because we're being choked by aggressive states that want to silence us. And I always say, democracy is not about having elections every 4 years. It's about having a viable opposition party, which is in danger in Canada as of yesterday. But most primarily, it's about a free press. It's about freedom of speech. That's why it's the First Amendment in the United States. It's the most primary chief objective of a democracy, is allow people to speak freely. And that is something that goes back to the Magna Carta in Great Britain. It is a sacred relic, and unfortunately it's becoming a relic, of Western civilization, of the democratic countries, of the English-speaking nations in the world. Free speech is the cornerstone. It's the foundation. And if we lose that, we lose everything. We lose it all, because we cannot be a democracy without free speech. You can have elections every 6 months, but it's only going to be one party. And even if there's more than one party, it's going to be the uniparty, which increasingly is happening in the United States with the Democrats and Republicans, and in your country, Labor and Conservative. I was on a radio show the other day, and somebody said, "Oh, looks like Labor is going to win in the UK. Isn't that awful?" And I said, "Makes no difference. Labor, Conservative, they're talking from the same sheet. There's no difference in these two parties. So what does it matter?" And thank God we still have some core differences in Canada between the Conservatives and the Liberals. But the uniparty is transcendent, is ascendant everywhere. And I think that is another result of globalization. But you're so right. We have to have a reformation today, because we are in danger of losing everything.
The freedom to speak, David, it's been the conversations that I have over and over with like-minded people always come back to the necessity of the freedom to speak. And, you know, you mentioned there in the context of Martin Luther, that he found his way back to acknowledging the sovereignty of the individual, you know, the necessity of each one of us to take responsibility for ourselves and for those around us. For as long as I'm able to, I'm going to have free and open conversations, David, and I hope very much, just mindful of time, I'm going to let you go on this one, but I will strenuously hope that you will come back to me very soon and we will pick up where we've left off and talk freely once again. Thank you, David Creighton.
Of course. Thank you so much, Neil. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And your show is always an inspiration for me.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.